Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have back PMH Atwater with her book, Near-Death Experiences, The Rest of the Story, What They Teach Us About Living, Dying, and Our True Purpose. PMH has had two near-death experiences or more. I can't remember exactly, but I know she had more than one, and then set upon a path of research, and I believe has spoken to more than 4,000 near-death experiencers and has written a really thoughtful and thought-provoking book in this particular book about putting together what she learned from her research. Thanks for joining us, PMH. I appreciate you taking the time.
Well, you know, it's good to be there. And by the way, I had three in 3 months.
There you go.
I look back.
I knew it was more than one.
I look back at what I went through, and I call it the heavenly sledgehammer effect.
Right.
You know, if one doesn't do the work, then you get it again and again. So I had three in 3 months.
There you go. Well, that's a theme of this book. Is there a purpose behind these near-death experiences? Are they simply random? And from your analysis of the research, I would say the evidence is really pretty clear-cut that in the majority of cases, there is a real purpose to near-death experiences and real changes that occur because of them.
Well, I think what we need to pay attention to is what the experiencers themselves are saying.
Mm-hmm.
And thousands and thousands of cases, the experiencers say the same thing. I got what I needed.
Mm-hmm.
We have to stop as researchers, as scientists, and take a look at that. Why are so many people saying, I got what I needed? And we find this even with children, that the parents or the healthcare providers will also say, you know, we got what we needed, or somehow, you know, the parents and the healthcare givers are significantly affected by what the child went through. And then when the child is older and looks back, they too are significantly affected. So we've got, you know, a whole range of input here that, in essence, is saying the same thing. You know, even though these are random, and they certainly are, There is somehow that synchronicity involved that input is there, that somehow these experiences are affecting people in a way that they need to be affected, or somehow, somehow there's an effect here that directly inputs on that person's life.
Right. And let me just go back a minute and talk about the sheer number of people that you've spoken to and the methods that you used when talking to them, because I think that's important.
It's nearly 4,000, not over.
Right. Okay. Well, let's say around 4,000.
Around 4,000, yeah. Okay.
There you go.
Adults and children.
Right. And from different countries and different religions and, you know, not just, say, in one area.
Right.
So this is more of a pan view of the experience worldwide. And you didn't use a specific, you weren't trying to narrow it down. You were using open-ended questions. You were listening rather than trying to direct, the interview.
Right.
And I think that's important. I think that's important to let people speak from their own, not rather a rigid pre-thought of evaluation, trying to get to a certain endpoint.
Well, yeah, right. That was important to me. Now, remember, I'm a cop's kid. I was raised in a police station.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up with this kind of behavior. Being demanded, And my dad, he started teaching me these kind of techniques at the age of 9. I don't know why, but he did. And he would always say, the body says more than the mouth does.
That's so true.
So you've got to watch a person's posture, how they move, how they dance, how they wiggle, you know, how they cross their arms or their legs. You've got to watch the eyes and the head.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm observing. And, you know, when you're working with kids, you never, ever, ever have your eyes above the eyes of the child. Never. Or you're in a power position. So if you're, you know, if you're working with little kids, you're either spending most of your time on the floor or you're on your belly.
Mm-hmm.
And you're working with these little kids and you're talking with them. And you can't have the parents around. They can be in the next room, you know, they can be watching hearing, but they can't be in that room because the child will always somehow gear what they say to either the parents or you know, other elders or older people that are in the room that they are familiar with. So you got to keep it clear. And it's the same way with adults. You've got to keep it clear.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're working with this really wide open arena of, you know, it's your stage. You tell me what you want to tell me. Dad, take for instance an accident. There's been an accident, and there are four witnesses. You cannot go up to the witnesses and say, describe the car accident. All you can do is say, what did you see?
Right.
Then and then only, if they use the word car, can you use the word car?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You can't use it.
That's true. They may not have seen the car accident. You know.
Right.
It is possible.
You know, it always has to be unbiased language. And
right.
This is the problem I've always had all these decades, because I've been doing this for over 33 years, is the scientific method is based on questionnaires or a particular script where you're using words like angels or light or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, the experiencer is looking at that and they're seeing words. You cannot give them words. They must give you words.
Right.
Otherwise, you're going to bias your study. And
so,
you know, I look at the scientific method and I say, well, you know, that's really wonderful for tracking disease and, you know, the after effects of any kind of treatment. But it's absolutely lousy if you're going to really look at the depths of consciousness and how the different things relate and come into play. You know, the only way you can look at that is to observe and to listen.
And it is important to understand, and I don't think some of our listeners appreciate, that there is no one type of near-death experience. There's one, like, template that there's variations on. There's different... And it probably, I think later in your book, you talk about the various levels, vibrational levels, that people seem to find themselves in once they leave this dimension. And they differ. I mean, anywhere from the very lower levels where they might encounter negative things that they, you know, would be more nightmarish, or in the higher dimensions, the more heavenly, the more light, the more... You know, the other things that are described are very different in quality, but it appears that there is a layering of dimensional realities beyond this one. It's not just that there's one place we go to or only two places we go to.
Well, absolutely correct. And I certainly want to say here that there is an overall global pattern in the sense of that basic play or scenario of how things occur. So
right.
there is that basic pattern. But within that pattern are all kinds of variations. And one of the things we have to look at here, or at least I chose to look at, is language constraints and culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because the individual, when describing their experience or what they went through or maybe they're still going through, they're going to use the language they're familiar with.
Right.
And that language is going to paint a picture a little bit differently
mm-hmm.
than, let's say, someone in Thailand or someone in the state of Wyoming. So what
right.
I would often do is I'd ask people to draw it
right.
rather than use words. And, and you know, these kinds of beings that people meet on the other side, that is to say the first or initial greeter,
mm-hmm.
Some people will call it an angel. If you live in Thailand, you're going to call it a Yamatut. You
mm-hmm.
know, you're going to have all these different words, but when they draw it out, it's basically the same kind of being.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, some being that is very knowledgeable, that knows all about you, that is coming
right.
there to either challenge you or help you, that is coming there to either guide you or cause you to think, or is in some way stimulating you or loving you, that whole venue. And,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of energy, that kind of being, is global.
Right.
You know, no matter how we want to describe it, it's still global. And another thing that I really, really caught on here to is this idea of the life review. And
mm-hmm.
and one of the things I noticed with different cultures, if the individual is from a culture that does not recognize I, that does not recognize a person as an individual, then
mm-hmm.
you're not going to get life reviews. But if you're with cultures where they recognize the individual as someone who is set apart, that,
mm-hmm.
that you can have your own identity, you can have your own life, and you can declare yourself as I, that's where you find your life reviews.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So these cultures where you don't find them, or at least very seldom find them, is something like Native Americans. You know,
mm-hmm.
they don't think of I, they think of we. They think
right.
of the tribe. They think of nature and working with the elders. So these
mm-hmm.
kind of cultures that think of we very seldom do their participants, their people, very seldom will they have a life review. And so I was looking at this and I was thinking, well, okay, this makes a lot of sense. Because if you don't think of yourself as an individual, why then would you have a life review?
Yeah, and it also extends into the religion the person was brought up in. If they were brought up Christian, they would be more likely to see a Christian-based figure sometime during the process than if they were brought up, say, Hindu. They would see more Hindu-based figures.
But you know, it usually works that way, but
mm-hmm.
not always. I have a case in one of my books. What is it? Closer to the Light, or something like that. I forget now.
Mm-hmm.
I've written 10 of these
right.
on my findings, so sometimes I forget what's in what. But in one of my books, I talk about. I think her name is Jeannie, and she was a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And she met Jesus in her experience. And,
well, Jesus was Jewish, so that there's at least a common link
to her,
there.
It insulted her. It absolutely
really?
Insulted her. Yes.
Interesting.
And she,
well, maybe she needed to get over that.
She absolutely attacked the man and just bantered back and forth in a very, very negative mm-hmm. way because she was insulted that he was in her experience. She said right to Jesus, she said, "I don't believe in you. Why are you here?" And it was an incredible scenario in that sense. Mm-hmm. Sort of battle that went back and forth, and after her near-death experience is over, and you know she was able to then heal from what the physical elements of that she did become a Christian.
Well, you know, she got what she needed. You know,
yeah,
and when you get what you need, some people embrace it and are thankful for it, and other people resist it and are bitter and angry. You know, I mean, getting what you need doesn't say anything about your own personal response to that
right.
event, you know. But,
absolutely.
And one of the books, I think we interviewed you on this book, you said that a lot of people that saw Jesus in the tunnel or in the experience described him the same, whether they were adults or children. Jesus looked very similar across all descriptions. I found that very interesting.
Similar, you know, not always the same, but similar.
Right.
And I just got a case last week from a prisoner, of mm-hmm. a fellow who was in prison and had a near-death experience because of being overdrugged in
mm-hmm.
prison because of some kind of health problem he had.
Yeah.
And he was dealing with the physical description of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about Jesus being red-haired and having blue eyes. And he couldn't
mm-hmm.
understand that because of where Jesus came from.
Right.
And I was able then to tell him and give him the references to the two different scrolls that are kept in either, you know, libraries or museums that
mm-hmm.
were written at the time when Jesus lived, that were sent to the Roman authorities because Jesus looked so differently that he could be recognized in a crowd. You wouldn't have to know that that was him because his
mm-hmm.
features were so different
mm-hmm.
that he could be recognized instantly. And what both of these scrolls said was that he had either red or wine color. Let's see, how did it go? Red gold hair or wine colored hair, and that
mm-hmm.
he had soft blue or gray eyes,
mm-hmm.
and he was unusually tall. So if
mm-hmm.
If you're looking around the crowd
in that part of the Middle East,
you're looking for a tall, basically redheaded person with
mm-hmm.
unusually light-colored eyes. You would know
right
away, that's the man.
Right.
And though not everybody sees that kind of Jesus, sometimes they see Jesus with brown hair,
mm-hmm.
I'm noticing that a goodly number get the red-headed, you know, light-colored eyes
mm-hmm.
version. And I'm, you know, as a researcher, I'm perking up.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I'm saying,
yeah.
Hey, wait, we have record of this.
Yeah, really. Well, that's interesting. So there is something about somebody's belief systems that does seem to play a role, at least in part of this. But then there are exceptions to that as well, especially when they're trying to expand their consciousness beyond the point where it is, like in the case of the Jewish woman, you know, where she was, you know, resistant to Jesus and then afterwards less resistant. So this is kind of like an increase in perception, an increase in consciousness to expand what the people are experiencing, and but it's more than just experiencing. It's what they're feeling, and it's a very, very deep level thing, and then they bring that back with them. That's what you've found, is that a lot of them bring this back with them.
And I want to sort of dwell a little bit on this idea that previous beliefs, and that it seems to somehow accommodate your previous beliefs. I have found that to be almost the opposite. The previous belief angle seems to have a lot to do with languaging. In other words, you're going to use words that somehow fit into how you want it to fit. Mm-hmm. But in fact, and I love the way you used expanded. But in fact, it expands that, and sometimes challenges that. And sometimes turns your previous beliefs on an ear.
It
just turns them upside
down.
Well,
it doesn't reinforce them, in other words. But
no, it
sometimes
doesn't.
You start with them. I mean, at least when you look at something, when you see that being of light, you see it as an angel because you're Christian, you see, rather than say atheist, you see.
Right.
I mean, you're going to your own recognition is colored by your belief systems. So it would be, you know, when you're describing it, you would say, I saw an angel. Well, that's more because you were taught that a being of light is an angel. That's all I'm saying.
Well, we really get that with children.
Right.
If the child is under the age of, let's say, about 5 or maybe 4 years of age, they don't use the term angel at all.
Right, right, because they don't have that.
You know, they've got to be older to be familiar with that term. They'll use terms like the bright people or the nice people or the bright ones. They won't use terms like angel.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's based on your socialization and, in particular, your religious figures, you know.
Right, and that's how... that's what you use to describe it. That's the languaging that you use, and then when you come to its parts that don't fit, then it's like flub, 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 glub, glub, glub. You know, what kind of words do you use? We don't have them in our language.
Right.
We just don't. And then you come back, kind of either disturbed or curious or. Stimulated or really wondering, you know, how do I describe this to people? What do I say to people?
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing that a lot now with some of the cases that are coming out there in the newest best-selling books, especially some of the children's books. This one little boy especially, and the father is, you know, really touched by what the boy described, and I think people need to stop and think here. Those are the kind of words and the kind of word pictures this child has received, even when in the womb, because the father was a minister. That's all he heard. That's all he was ever exposed to. So, of course, that's the kind of verbiage the child's going to use. Now, I'm not saying that he's colored anything. I'm saying he's being true to his own exposure as a child. My bet is, as he grows older and as he looks at his own experience again, he may then spread it out a little bit and begin to be open to other ways of looking at what he, as a child, once described. And again, you see this a lot, too.
Yeah. So when people come back, be it children or adults, there are certain changes that you describe in the book that tend to be there.
Part, few people ever talk about the after effects. They just talk about the nice stuff that Raymond Moody talked about. You know, they become nicer afterward, more loving, more generous, more humanitarian.
But also, no longer sometimes more depressed. Yeah, more depressed, more not feeling like they don't fit in.
People go through lots of phases of depression afterward because they find out that they just don't fit their family, their society, their job anymore. That suddenly they're different. Suddenly they seem to know more. They seem to see things in a very different light. And they're struggling for words on how you describe this. And then also they're puzzled by the physiological after effects. Nobody talks about that, like being suddenly an electrical sensitive. You're very sensitive to electricity and digital kinds of things, electronic kinds of things. You can't wear watches anymore.
You make your computer go dead?
Yeah, I work with a lot of people describing how to handle that.
Yeah, I have friends that were struck by lightning multiple times, and you know, Daniel Brinkley talks about how that changes you. I mean, you not only have the near-death experience, but you really have something in your electromagnetic field that is just strange.
It changes your electromagnetic field. Both adults and children.
Right.
So you're going to see what we now can point to is that there are structural and functional differences in the brain afterward, as well as changes in the nervous and digestive system, very often in skin sensitivity. So we're talking about fundamental biological changes because of these episodes.
And I want to add something here that you may have known. You know, I went through a spiritual shift in the 90s, and the physiological and electromagnetic changes, I broke 10 things in one day. I remember doing that. And then I fixed 9 of them and returned the one I didn't want. But, you know, you don't have to have a near-death experience to have these physiological changes. What you have to have is an awakening.
You know,
a spiritual awakening to do that.
That's what got me in trouble with the book Near-Death Experiences, The Rest of the Story. You know, that's the summation of all my work.
Mm-hmm.
And people love the first half of the book. And chapter 16 changes the book. And, the name of that chapter is The Key is Intensity.
Right.
And that's when I show... And I believe, show very strongly, that anybody who's had a near-death experience, a near-death-like experience, a kundalini breakthrough, or any type of impactful spiritual experience, no matter how caused, will manifest the same pattern, or nearly so, of physiological and psychological after effects that a near-death experiencer goes through. So my premise in the second half of the book is this is what we must look at when we're looking at changes to the human body. Spiritual experiences, transformative experiences, you know, we can talk about those all we want. But we need to admit here that these are fundamental changes and breakthroughs that a human being can go or grow through. They are not just a religious experience. They are not just people becoming more inspired or loving. These are fundamental core changes. And they are also changes to the core genetics in the individual, We now know through research that how an individual changes in any given life can pass on genetically to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's called Lamarckism. And I talk about that in the book. So we're talking about what I believe these kind of experiences really are.
Right.
And I'm taking the whole bunch here, and I'm saying they are a biological imperative. They are how the human race evolves and becomes more intelligent and
mm-hmm.
becomes more whole. That it is that near-death experiences, near-death-like experiences, Kundalini breakthroughs, spiritual experiences,
mm-hmm.
the idea of the mountaintop experience, if intense enough,
right.
are indeed a biological imperative that changes our race and enables us to evolve as a human family. So, you know, these are not flippant kinds of things. These are not unique kinds of things. These are not oddities. Mm-hmm. But I believe are part of that grander picture of how we evolve as humans.
Let me give you an example of what is... I was guided as I was a plastic surgeon, and I kept getting this idea that I was going to take like 5 or 6 months off, which is weird, you know. I mean, you don't usually just go on a sabbatical. But then I did it. I just quit my job, became vegetarian, worked with a group of clairvoyants, you know, very intense, fasted, you know, all the different things you do just out of the blue. But then I'm thinking, well, how many people have the financial resources and the opportunity to do that? Not that many. I mean, you know, you have children, you have
right.
a job that has demands, you're in a family, you've got to be all the family demands. I mean, I didn't have that. I wasn't married. You know, I had relative freedom to go on my spiritual path. But then it occurred to me that people have near-death experiences because it's easier than taking 5 months off.
Well, I wouldn't say it's easier. Confrontive experiences, dear. I mean,
well, you know what I mean. It's more feasible within the person's life demands.
Well, you have to, because you know what a lot of us forget is that most near-death experiences come from violence or trauma.
Right.
So that
childbirth.
When the experience is over, you've got a body to rebuild.
Exactly.
You know, I had three of these experiences in 1977, between January and March. I had three in 3 months. And then afterward, not only am I dealing with what I went through and what I was shown
mm-hmm.
and what I experienced
right.
and how I'm changing because of that,
mm-hmm.
I had to relearn how to walk, how to stand, how to climb stairs, how to run, how to see the difference between, how to recognize the difference between left and right.
Mm-hmm.
I had to relearn how to think, how to see, how to hear. I had to rebuild all of my belief systems. Toward the end of that year, I had three major relapses. I had come to the point where I was literally jealous of anybody who was healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Because no matter what I did, I got worse instead of better. And of course, in my case, what happened to me was I had friends and a doctor who got me all shot up with drugs so that I could then
mm-hmm.
go with my friends. They took me to, I was living in Idaho, they took me to Seattle, Washington, and then I was able to attend the Mind Miraculous Symposium, put on mm-hmm. in Seattle Center. And those were the days of Dr. Brew Joy, Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and so forth and mm-hmm. so on. And the first speaker paid for my trip. Mm-hmm. And that first speaker was William Tiller, the
right, yeah.
Stanford. And
right.
he described, his topic was the, I think it was called Oneness or the Eternal Now or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you a thing the man said, except at the close of his talk, he had flashed up onto that huge, giant screen a picture of a drawing of what he felt proves that there is such a thing as simultaneity. And
mm-hmm.
and he flashed up there exactly what I saw and dealt with in my third near-death experience. And
mm-hmm.
I got up from my chair, and I ran out into the foyer, and I collapsed under a light, and I cried and cried and cried. And I kept
mm-hmm.
saying, I'm not crazy. He
mm-hmm.
saw it too. I'm not crazy. And from that moment on, I got well.
Right.
But you see, you need something, or I did. You need, and I think most
you needed an outside.
You need validation.
Validation, exactly, from somebody who was a scientist, because that was your
case,
path.
Yeah,
yeah.
In that case,
couldn't be a preacher. You know that wouldn't
no.
have been as good.
No,
or as
no,
validating.
It would have been as
that wasn't the system you were supposed to work in, right?
Well, yeah.
And you know, let me tell you another thing that these illnesses do, because I've been seriously ill, unable to get up and go to the bathroom, unable to eat, you know, for weeks on end on IVs, you know. It takes your ego down. It takes your ego down.
Oh yeah.
It disassembles your ego.
Yeah.
Because you realize that unless God gives you energy and you really understand when you're getting energy from this other dimension, because you feel it as you get well, you know, that the burst of energy is coming in that are multidimensional. You really understand that you, of your own small will, you know, the personality will, is pretty helpless. You know? 'Cause you're experiencing it.
Yeah,
you know, you
yeah,
can't
yeah,
will
yeah,
yourself.
Yeah.
You can't will yourself to get well.
Well, you know, you can put yourself in that positive mind frame.
True.
You can do your visualization.
True.
You can
learn
your
lesson.
Prayer and meditative
yes.
work.
Yeah.
But you must always recognize and affirm that of myself, I can do nothing.
Exactly. And when you feel that energy flow into you from
yes.
another dimension that
it's,
really
oh
starts
God.
To heal your body,
yeah.
you realize... You know, only by the grace of God am I getting out of this bed.
Right. I'm
well, you
in
know,
a
not
bed.
Everybody, not everybody has been in that situation. You
That's
know, I mean,
true.
The majority
true.
Of people in America probably haven't. You know, I mean, third world countries maybe because they have more illness, but you know, the majority of people have not been put down that far. But so many spiritually based people have. It's very interesting.
Oh yeah, they've been knocked on their little tootsies here.
Well, look at the saints. All of the saints went through these weird
oh,
illnesses.
Yes.
Seizures
and
you know all sorts of neurological stuff.
Had a near death experience too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, they did. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's to teach the personality that it is secondary.
Oh, is it ever?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. It's absolutely God first. I mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
For me, I breathe God. God is my life.
Right. Right.
God is my breath. Yeah. You know, a lot of people don't realize. Because I don't talk about it. I mean, why talk
mm-hmm.
about it?
Right.
I'm a researcher. This is what I'm talking about. I
yeah.
talk about my papers. I talk about my books. But
yeah.
people don't realize I've never chosen to write a single book. Never,
no.
never. Never did.
It was your
the
life
book
path.
It always came to me. No, it always came
right.
to me. And it comes to me with sparkles. The room will just light up with all these sparkles, and the sparkles flop on my desk, and there will be the title of the book or what the book is about. But I've learned, yes, God, I've learned not to take anything on first call.
Right.
Always then you take that into your prayer life and you say something to the effect of, you know, did I get it right? Did I understand this right? Is this really what you want me to do for my highest good and the highest good of all concerned? Is it your will, not my will? And if I get a yes, then and then only do I start the rough draft, I plan it out, and I go forward. Always there is that moment, I believe, where you must recheck. Is this your ego doing this? Is this illusion? Is this a trickster of some kind from the other side? What's really going on here? Is this true guidance? Or is it what I think or want or assume might be guidance? I want to know, is it true guidance?
Right.
And so I always do that double checking. Always.
Yeah, I think... you know, I think that your body of work, I mean, nobody else that I've interviewed has such an extensive research body of work. So you truly are doing something that has not been done before.
Well, you know, I was told to do this.
Yeah.
I was told to do this in my third near-death experience, where I felt I was at the center point of creation and consciousness, and while I was there, I heard this voice speak, and it's not like a voice. You know, how do you describe something that big? I called it the voice like none other, and my sense was it was of God, and this voice said very little. It said, and I quote, test revelation. You are to do the research. One book for each death. Then it named books 2 and 3, not book 1. It showed me what was to be in each book, but it did not tell me how to do it or how long that would take. And I was sent back to do the work.
Right.
Literally, I became an obsessive, driven individual.
Right.
And I pulled back from my background. Isn't it interesting that I had that kind of background, that I had that kind of father? So I brought that forward and said, yes, this is what I will use as my protocol. And I'm the only person on this planet that we know of that went out on her own and did her own research on the near-death experience, not knowing anything about Raymond Moody, his book, or the so-called classical model.
Raymond was an MD and a psychiatrist, so he approached it
through... Yeah, but I've never heard of him.
Yeah, he approached it through a different realm, which is more the medical model. You know, that's that's a well-known model for
near-death. Who gave me the term, because I met her at the O'Hare Airport. I was there, she was there, her plane was late for Europe, it was about an hour late, so we sat on a bench, just the two of us, like a couple of little schoolgirls. And I told her about my experience, and she was the one who validated my experience and said I was a near-death survivor. She did not use the term experiencer. She used survivor. And then she told me what the near-death experience was. And that's the first time I've ever heard anything about it. She never mentioned Raymond or any of the other stuff. And that that's all I needed. You know,
right.
I needed a term, I needed an idea, and I was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Kenneth Ring, years later, who found the book I wrote. with the original title, I Died Three Times in 1977, The Complete Story.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you love it? He found it on a bookstore in Connecticut. Hartford, Connecticut. How it ever got there? I only printed 50 copies. How it ever got there, I don't know. But it did. And then he traced me down by telephone and on and on and on, finally found me, came over and stayed overnight with my husband and myself. And we talked all night. And the next morning he said, "You know more than anybody else. You have done more than anybody else. Now get yourself up to Storrs, Connecticut, and meet your peer group." And that's what I did.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about this idea of being shown things in the future during the near-death experience. I think that that is...
I don't have it with me right now, but it's out. Where is it? On Huffington Post, or it's out, you know, all over the social media. There's this group in Illinois, Neuroscience Foundation, Julia Mossmer, maybe, who has just released their study on... That validates that the human being can pick up the future before it occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fabulous study. And I just heard about it, I think, 2 days ago. And so I wrote this Julia an email yesterday. I hope she gets it right away. that I would like to take her work and what HeartMath has done over in California, what I have done with the after effects and near-death experiences, and take all three and put them together. Because what it's showing is, certainly in my work, that that one of the after effects of the near-death experience is what I call future memory, or certainly where people become much more comfortable with anything future, whether you want to call it clairvoyance or deja vu. Well, deja vu is past, but clairvoyance are on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea, more specifically, of future memory is that people who have episodes where they find themselves living the future in detail before it ever happens. And then they're suddenly back in their present life, living their own present life with its own timing. And then when the event is supposed to occur, then it does. And very often the person will remember that they've already lived it, or maybe there'll be a trigger point that brings back the memory. Some people claim that they can change it. Other people claim that, no, it can't be changed. And my book on this, called, interestingly, Future Memory, and by the way, that was book two that I was supposed to write. It was named by the voice, not me. And the voice came back years later and showed me how to write the book, Future Memory. So that has just been reissued. It's only been out now about 2 weeks.
Really?
So it's been reissued by Future Mem. By Hampton Roads. It is just now out. It has a great new cover, and it's all updated. The resource section and the notes are all updated. But they allowed me to rewrite, totally change that little advance piece before chapter one. It's called The Purpose of This Book. I threw out the old one, put in the new one, where they finally allowed me to write what this book really is and how it was written.
Mm-hmm.
The book. I wrote that book in 7 different formats. I'm not saying I wrote it 7 different times. I'm saying I wrote it in 7 different formats. One of the things I do with my books is I send it out to peer review before mm-hmm. I hand it over to a publisher, or about mm-hmm. the same timing. So I get peer review back. And the peer review always kept saying, you know, fascinating book, but it doesn't make any sense. So I kept, you know, trying a new format and trying another format. Mm-hmm. And nothing worked, and I finally gave up. And I was taking a shower on a Saturday morning, and suddenly, you know, time and space cease. The air fills up with these sparkles. Don't you love it, those mm-hmm. sparkles? And then I hear the voice like none other. And it spoke. And the voice said, turn it into a labyrinth. I'll show you how.
Really?
So I could hardly, you know, dry up real fast, get right downstairs. I followed what I was told
mm-hmm.
and turned the whole book around in 2 weeks, and it sold the next week. So
mm-hmm.
it went right out then.
Mm-hmm.
What Future Memory is, the book, is it's not a book. It's a site. It is a labyrinth. The instructions I received was how to take every sentence, every paragraph, every page, and use a particular mathematical formula, then using that to turn it into a labyrinth, into a real labyrinth,
mm-hmm.
the labyrinth format. Therefore, when you read the book, you can't skip read it, or it won't make any sense, and you'll wonder
mm-hmm.
why I ever wrote such a dumb book.
You have to
read through it like you walk through a sight labyrinth, because it's a real
mm-hmm.
labyrinth. And so the book will change on you like any labyrinth path does.
Mm-hmm.
Stay on the path. The purpose of the book is the same as the purpose of a labyrinth, any labyrinth. And that is to bring your consciousness up to the next highest level possible
mm-hmm.
for you at that time. Any labyrinth is a brain changer. So is the book. It
mm-hmm.
is a it wound up being a psychotronic device. I tell everybody the book's alive. It works on you as you read it.
Mm-hmm.
So that particular book is now out 2 weeks.
Well, we'll have to get it and get you on for an interview.
Oh, that would be fun. Because that's a very unique pathway, the pathway
yeah.
of the labyrinth, and how it then works on the brain-mind assembly and
mm-hmm.
enables you then to expand. Yeah. So that's just out. I'm very grateful for it, but you know, it's only been out 2 weeks, and then here's this big news. And certainly HeartMath was able to show that the heart, you know, the heart is our fifth brain.
Mm-hmm.
About 60 to 65% of all the cells in the heart are neural cells. So it,
mm-hmm.
you know, works like a brain. And they've now been able to show that it is indeed our fifth brain. They've also been able to show through the science that the heart reacts to... will pick up and react to what is going to happen about a half a minute, maybe a minute before it occurs. In some cases, several minutes before it occurs. So your
mm-hmm.
heart literally is your first responder. Well, what this team in Illinois found is that all of our perceptual abilities, especially intuition, pick this up too.
Mm-hmm.
So
I often see an accident before it occurs to me, on me, you know, or
yeah.
I'll see it happen and then it'll happen.
But the point of this group in Illinois is that it registers in the physical body
mm-hmm.
before anything happens. So it's not just something we're picking up in our heads or our feelings or our emotions
mm-hmm.
or our spirit, you know, what we normally call our intuition that,
right.
You know, this is coming. But the physical body, without any precursor,
mm-hmm.
is responding to this as if it had occurred before
mm-hmm.
it happened. So we're getting this from the physical body people. We're getting this from the heart people. We're also getting this from near-death studies. And I myself is just going hip hip hooray.
mm-hmm.
We're getting this from all these different inputs saying the same thing, and I'm going yes. We're finally waking up and realizing that the human body is this exquisite creation that is capable of far more than we think it is.
True. Well, we're coming up on the last few minutes of our interview. Would you like to give your contact information?
Well, certainly my website, www.pmhatwater.com, all lowercase, one word, pmhatwater.com. And I would invite everybody out there, be sure you sign up for my free monthly newsletter. And you sign up on my website. All addresses are private. You know, I never sell them or share them with anybody for any reason. This is private. There will be a special edition coming out probably tomorrow. Might be coming out even today. On another one on electrical sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
I've been covering this as near-death experiencers. Now I'm broadening that picture and covering it for the average person, and especially as relates to cell towers, smart meters, and so forth and so
mm-hmm.
on.
Right.
So I've got a special notice about that. And then this article on synesthesia that's in the online version of Psychology Today just went out. It was supposedly an interview of Eben Alexander, the neurosurgeon who had a near-death experience. But
mm-hmm.
it's also a treatise on synesthesia. And I was called in on an expert in the field. So was Dr. Pim Van Lommel. Another good friend, and so that article, the link to that article, is on this special edition as well. So, you know, there's
great.
An archive there, so anybody who wants to read previous editions,
mm-hmm.
Certainly, I consider myself a little bit of a maverick, and so you never know what I'm going to cover.
right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate that. We've been interviewing PMH Atwater, whose latest book, Near-Death Experiences, The Rest of the Story, What They Teach Us About Living, Dying, and Our True Purpose. And as she said in the interview, her most recent book is a reissue called Future Memory, and that is more of what happens to experiencers in terms of being able to experience that which is in the future, not just during the near-death experience, but probably afterward as well. Sounds like a very fascinating book. It's a labyrinth experience. That would be great. And we hope to interview her on that, too. I'll get in touch with Hampton Roads on that one. Thank you so much for joining us. PMH, I really appreciate it and look forward to our next interview.
You betcha. Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Next week, we are interviewing Philip Coppins Philip is on the TV show Ancient Alien, and we're interviewing him on his book, The Lost Civilization Enigma. On the 9th, we're interviewing Henry Massey, Choice Point, Align Your Purpose. On the 16th, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, What Went Wrong, The Truth Behind the Clinical Trial of the Enzyme Treatment of Cancer. And on the 23rd, Dr. Rita Louise, Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods. Noetic Science meeting will be on a free lecture on Sachewitz, The X Factor by Lee Culver. That's at 7:30 at our Dunwoody office on the 21st, third Thursday. And then every Wednesday, we have an Abraham Hicks meetup group, The Law of Attraction, given by Kent Boxberger at 7:30 p.m., also at the Dunwoody office. And then on the 25th, on Monday the 25th, Dr. Mike Greenberg's giving a free lecture on the 5 Keys to Permanent Weight Loss. That'll be at 7:30, also at the Dunwoody office. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.